the nature of U.S. interest in Southeast Asia is quite complex, more so in Vietnam. Even when U.S. interests are less complex, we have had and have always had difficulty in acting on them. 1917, when the chips were down, with the German declaration of unrestricted warfare, and I don't know if you know this, the Zimmerman note promised the Mexicans that they would return Texas to Mexico if they, the Germans, won the war. Well, that in that condition, it was not difficult for Wilson to gain congressional support for a declaration of war that hitherto had deeply divided the country. 5 months before, he had been elected under the slogan, "He kept us out of war, too proud to fight." But the critical circumstances required to bring the country to act on the basis of a wide consensus then developed. In the same case with Pearl Harbor, bring the U.S. into World War II. After a long period of having been dominated by isolationism that Roosevelt tried hard but couldn't really break. And it took the straightforward invasion of South Korea to invoke a military response there. But what Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson were trying to prevent in Southeast Asia was a circumstance that did not appear to the general public as that stark and dangerous, and not a precipitative kind of event. Johnson tried to make the Gulf of Tonkin incident into it, but didn't really convince anybody of that at the time. So you had the case where a lot of policymakers in Washington and the whole Eastern Seaboard, I would say, the influentials, did perceive that vital interests were in jeopardy there, but this was not widely supported throughout the United States. This has really always been the case. We've oscillated between isolationism, indifference, and wishful thinking, and complacency on foreign and policy matters on the one hand, and the kind of panic-stricken retrieval of the situation. It's already advanced into dangerous deterioration. It happened again, continues to happen. I don't think there's much to really do about it. Better appreciation of history, I guess, is one answer. Another objective observation was that there was a kind of geological fault line between those who regard balance of power in Southeast Asia as important for the U.S. in itself and those holding the Atlanticist, Atlantic first, Europe first policy, but regarded our maintenance of our commitments there in Southeast Asia as significant only for the viability of commitments elsewhere, as in Europe or the Middle East. Finally, to return to an earlier theme, the geopolitics for the Vietnamese in terms of looking at the U.S. and U.S. interests. After years in Vietnam, I'm convinced it's necessary to rewrite the 19th century aphorism on foreign relations, more actively, I believe. There are no permanent alliances, only permanent interests. I think this must be written into new language. There are no permanent relations, only permanent perceptions. Again and again, one is struck with the enormous durability of this perceptual chemistry. Apathies based on surface after centuries of burial, as with Cambodians and the Vietnamese, apparently changed perceptions eventually proved to not have been changed at all, with China's application for power. Whether the perception is correct or irrelevant is not what counts. What counts is how strongly it is held. Now, perception in transcultural terms is both product and function. It's a two-way communication of ideas. At the subliminal level, this process is largely determined by the affective or motive communication that takes place. Vietnamese and foreign efforts to communicate with each other at this emphatic level are subject to two major impediments. One of them is peculiarly Vietnamese, the other is more universally common. The first barrier we treated in last Tuesday's lecture is on various Vietnamese religions and secular influences. Buddhist modesty, self-effacement, other worldliness, Confucian scholarly reserve, island of the lake mentality. These attitudes or perceptions dictate that if efforts to communicate effectively plead one's case, to reach out and touch someone, as the AT&T TV commercial, that that sort of thing is improper. It's beneath one's dignity. Intermixed with this is the singular Vietnamese heritage of the politics of clandestinism, which you'll hear much about later. This politics of clandestinism with which the Vietnamese have always dealt with foreign occupiers, first the Chinese, then the French, in which, if possible, all straightforward communication is eschewed, avoided. Second communicational barrier is made up of the conflicting patterns of thought we noted earlier, the cognitive dimension, just tracing to differing conceptual and philosophic time framework. Just to remind you from the last two, our perceptual heritage is Greek aesthetics, Roman engineering, Christian monotheism, Judaic laws, rational Kantian geometrics. Vietnamese heritage is circuitous, amorphous, and multidimensional. So both of these systems have thrown up differing value concepts involving space, time, and causality, which form permanent and virtually unreachable walls. I spent the summer of 1969 in South Vietnam POW and Chu Hoi camps. Defector returnee, literally camps, conducting depth interviews with middle-ranking North Vietnamese cadres and field grade officers in their mid-30s. Some of these interviews went on for several days, and they ranged widely. My purpose at the time was to learn more about the mindset and the political outlook of North Vietnam's next generation of leaders. My main findings, which unfortunately were burned up in fire in the embassy, but I have some notes left. My findings can be summarized as follows. And these are the people that are now coming to power in North Vietnam. Not these necessarily, but people of this, I would say, the same mindset. First, they demonstrated a uniformly high level of idealism. They made elaborately detailed moral judgments, and they offered a highly ethical value system, strikingly similar in many ways when compared to the value systems that you would hear from South Vietnamese at the time. I would often say to them, why are you down here? Well, I'm here to unite the Holy Fatherland. I say, well, do you really care about that? Well, no, not exactly. Actually, I'm here because I was sent. I'm here because my friends are here, because my family expected me to be here. The same reason the Americans wouldn't answer if you said, why are you here? So what would you really like to do if you followed? Well, what I'd really like to do is to go back to North Vietnam and turn it into a perfect socialist utopian society in which we solve all our social, political, economic problems. Now, these are from people who are 30-some years old. That's the kind of idealism you don't expect. You certainly didn't find it in the South Vietnamese. But you do find it very young. First year I was in college as a freshman, I went home that summer and I wrote a constitution for the world. And if the world will only adopt this constitution will solve all of their problems. And I really believed in it too. I could hardly read it 10 years later. God, did I write this? Anyway, that's the point is that there's a kind of arrested development, I guess you would say. The second point, maybe, because they tended to be credulous or even naive about international relations and world policies in general. Now, both of these reflected the educational system at the time, in which they were highly insulated from infusion of foreign ideas, even Marxist ideas. Very few of them, I came to this from having been a specialist on Marxism at Cal. This is what I did my undergraduate work on. And these people weren't Marxists at all. I mean, they didn't know anything about Marx. They never taught anything and read anything. They had a few slogans, 3 or 4. That's the most they knew about. And I think, as they said in Moscow, that is no accident comment. The Party of the North didn't really want people to know much about Marxism, other than a kind of icon on the wall. Gave me a great deal of trouble when writing Viet Cong. People willing to fight and die for something they don't even understand. And they acknowledge that they don't understand it. They don't think it makes any difference that they don't understand. It's what the French called the convent society. Third, there was just to complete this view of the new generation. There's virtually unanimous allegiance to the North Vietnamese socio-political system and commitment to Hanoi's enunciated goal in the war, that is, unification of Vietnam. More strikingly, it seems to me that it hardly occurred to these cadres to question authority or to even wonder whether there was some question to be asked about the underlying philosophic basis of their society. And finally, most of these cadres demonstrated a hostility which tinged on xenophobia, both toward the USSR and China, although for differing reasons, and to some extent to the world in general. Even among party members, the call for proletarian internationalism seemed to exert very little influence. This goes back to the duck left theory. You fear the foreigner, but you need the foreigner. Okay, I guess that's about all I have to say. Yes? Any questions, comments?